The keywords, you know, topic I'm going to talk about are things related to the S matrix of ADS5 plus S5, integrability. But I'm not going to say as much about those topics in particular. I'll discuss some semi-classical solutions that that allow us to understand this problem a little bit better. So I want to start with a motivation slash history introduction. So I was talking to giving a Blackboard talk, so this is going to be a nice experiment. Good. So first thing I want to talk about is some history. So we are interested in duality between strings on ADS5 plus S5 and n equals 4 to the young male. So in the very beginning of this story, most calculators were done by obtaining triangulations between BPS objects. These objects are nice because they we can calculate things for them for all values of the coupling. So because this is a string, this is a weak, strong duality, which makes it powerful, also makes it very difficult to test. And BPS options are such that we can calculate things for all values of the coupling and compare what happens to both sides of the correspondence. Now, of course, people ask, well, can we do more than that? Can we go beyond BPS objects? So, well, everything I'm going to say is going to be in the planar limit. So we'll be taking an infinity lambda well, principle fixed. We'll discuss this in a minute. So this is, we'll talk about this in a minute. So, and in this setup, let's discuss what happens for gauge theories and strings. So what I'm going to discuss is some old story about BMN operators and such. So for gauge theories, you have this on one side, and I'll put strings on this side. So for gauge theories, we can start with a BPS state, which is given by this. So I will only consider single trace operators because I'm in the planar limit. And this state is such that what I'll call small, what I'll call epsilon, which is delta minus k is zero. And this is a BPS state. It preserves half the symmetries. And this corresponds to a massless mode of 10-dimensional supergravity. In this case, epsilon is energy minus j. J is angular momentum over here. It's an R charge over here. So, well, okay, I didn't say z is this, where these are the six scalars of super young males. This is a combination of two of them. And this zero mode is given by a particle rotating around a sphere with angular momentum j. So this is the most naive setup we can have, where instead of strings, we're looking at particles spinning around a sphere. So now what can we do next? So the next thing we can think of is consider this state we introduce. An impurity. So we consider this state. Which is just some rotation, let's call it. So W is, let's say W is okay. So So it's just some rotation of this other state. On this other state. Good. So this state is such that. Sorry?
It's too small.
Too small, okay, good. So the experiment is starting to fail. Good, too small. Everything's too small, just that.
No, just.
Good. Sorry. This. Where this one is here, because there's another angular momentum, or another Casimir of the SV4 group, which is one, which is the angular momentum that comes with that scalar. So that's the story over there. And for string theory, this is just an excitation of zero mode, and this, well, this thing is massive, this is a flat space, and this is, you get the same result. So what happens here is that this is a state with lowest energy and this charge. So this state still BPS. So we thought we were getting somewhere, but this state still BPS, and this is how it works. But now that we introduce an impurity, you get an idea. So what we do is what we always do, which is construct a block state. So we construct this operator. So we sum over all these states such that we change the position of this impurity. Now, well, these states are what we call magnets. I'll explain why in a second. P, if we, well, I'll discuss the trace in a minute. So there's a catch here. And the catch is that because of the trace, all these states vanish. If we take the trace of this state such that we make a gauge invariant, all these things turn out to be the same, and we're summing all these spaces, and all the spaces just vanish. So this state is not really allowed. So we cannot consider these states when we have to pull the trace condition. But we can consider states with two impurities. So.
What do you do with the delta function that we have? When p is zero, it's the only case it doesn't know.
Exactly. So that's the case I discussed above. Okay. Yes, that's correct. P equals zero is the only case where this doesn't vanish, and that's the case we discussed above. For all other pieces, this vanishes. So let's have another equation here.
So how does J scale n was simply under 6, and what happens in J?
Sorry?
How does J scale?
J. At this point, I'm not saying anything about J. And then all these states are actually assuming I'm taking J to be infinite, because this point where I don't have to perform calculation. So J will be infinite in a minute. But I'm not saying much about that at this point. So, good. So I'm considering these states, and these are tricky, these are not really allowed, but states with two impurities are allowed, so I can put two of these impurities and make them move with some p, and those are actually good states. These are non-BPS states. So in principle, these are tough to analyze, but we'll see in a minute, this is the work of BMM, that we can actually analyze these states. So we have to solve basically the spectrum of impurities. So we have W's running in a chain of Z's. And it turns out that this problem can actually be mapped to a problem of spin chain. So we can, if we want to solve a spectrum of, let's say, chain, we can map this problem to a problem of spin chain, where we define the Hamiltonian, there's going to be an Hamiltonian chain. And there's a particular spin chain that gives us the maps to this problem. So these two problems turn out to be equivalent. Now, back to this trace. So, because I want to consider a space with only one impurity, because the things are simpler, it seems natural in some sense to drop the trace, forget about it, and consider this state. We'll see in a minute how that, why that makes sense. Also, because we want to solve this problem from a spin chain point of view, we want to solve the scattering matrix, where the scattering matrix is such that in the asymptotic space, so if you have this trace amounts to boundary conditions, and it means that you're actually working in a circle, and define the S-matrix there is tricky. So it makes physical sense to also think of this spin chain as an open spin chain with asymptotic states, and that amounts to dropping the trace. So I will consider these states for the open spin chain, and you can wonder now, are they VPS? I mean, this state with B equals zero was VPS. We know that these states are not, and these states, well, they don't really look really VPS. I mean, they have a momentum. But it's strict business, and we'll discuss this in a moment. There's actually a good reason why it will be VPS. So following this procedure, I can solve the spin chain problem. I can, by working the gauge theory, I can calculate this Hamiltonian to different orders in perturbation theory. And this problem was solved. And perturbation theory, for example, the first order, I think, there might be factors of pi squared, depending on conventions, but this is a last order. So that's the solution to this problem. So we have prediction for these states in this case. And actually, this problem was solved exactly by Weiser by just using the symmetries of the problem. The problem has some SU. Oh, this, I cannot move this. Okay. So the problem has SE2/2 square symmetries. And by using these symmetries and this open chain picture, Weiser actually showed that this algebra gets enlarged by two central charges. And these central charges are actually very important in solving this problem. So in the open chain, this gets enlarged by central charges. And, well, you can solve the problem exactly by just using symmetry. So supersymmetry is very powerful. And the solution is actually following this exact solution. So this is the exact solution for the spectrum of these states. And, of course, the central charges, one way of thinking what they do is very similar to some VRST quantization where you have some charge. Physical states are neutral under these charges. So in this case, this is pretty much the same. It's a similar procedure where this, you have these extra central charges and these states on the open chain are charged under the central charges. And the states that actually live in the closed chain are neutral under this charge. So those are the physical states. Requiring physical states amounts to requiring to consider only the neutral sector.
So there is no sense in which these guys are part of the original uniforms for?
No, not with the closed string. No, not with the trace. So if you want to consider gauge invariant operators, no, they're not. They're charged under this large.
What are the charges under? What are the two charges that the state carries?
So, well, In the gauge theory, it's technical. I will discuss that in detail for the string theory. In the gauge theory, what these charges do, these are operators that add, that make the spin chain dynamical. So these are operators that actually insert scalars on one side and the other side of the impurity. It's actually changing the length of the chain. So it's kind of algebraic procedure. I don't know if I can say more than that about what they mean. It's very clear what they mean in string theory. I'll discuss this. So this is oh okay so I died. good. So I lied for the first time. And lies the following. The actual result, vice versa, that this thing is actually a function of lambda. So we don't know what that is. Symmetries only tell us that this is the actual formula where you use an arbitrary function of lambda. I use this formula because this matches this perturbative result. And will also match the strong coupling result, so the string theory result. And so for people who say there's no experimental physics in string theory, this is my experimental result. Experimentally, f of lambda we will always take to be this for all values of lambda. Of course, we only know this for weak coupling and strong coupling, and we don't really know what happens in the middle. But some people believe that this is actually the right answer for all values of the coupling. One interesting feature of this, and that I will probably say a little bit more when I discuss the string theory, is that that other theories that have the same symmetries might have a different f of lambda. And this is actually the case for plane wave matrix models and other theories that have the same symmetries. This function is actually different. So this is a very general statement about theories with this symmetry. That's not tell us about the dynamics.
Sorry, in these other examples, the small lambda and large lambda asymptotics are also the same or different?
Sorry, they're this. They're given by this function at weak coupling and strong coupling.
So my question, so in this example you said that lambda over pi squared is at weak coupling and also at strong coupling, right? So the other examples, it's also the same, so the weak coupling result is the same as the strong coupling result. I guess my question can be reformulated. Is there an indication that f lambda is non-constant?
Well, it's non-constant here. It depends on... Well, you think it's not linear lambda?
Yeah, it's not linear, yeah.
I mean, I can just plug in a function here that's linear on the extremes. Okay. I don't know what that means for other theories, right? It's just some function of lambda. This case turns out to be this function. There's some other function. Whether that's the same or not, it's just a function. Good. So this is a result. And what about strings now? So we want to consider strings and the setup where we consider the plane wave limit, so we can see a PP wave limit.
Okay. Can I go back to the question analysis before? So, can you write what's the expression of the central charge in terms of the field that equals 4? Can you write that for the linear charge for that? Or?
These are charges that are very strange looking because they insert operators, so they're very complicated. They're exponentials of exponentials that include the momentum. But, I mean, these charges are related to the total momentum. So this is what these charges are telling me. Basically, what you learn from these charges is the momentum of the configuration. The trace is telling you that the level matching condition string theory, the total momentum should be zero. So these charges are basically telling you about the momentum of this configuration. So it's related to some translational symmetry, if you want, in this spin chain. Right? But this discrete translational symmetry. So they have the usual e to the I something, b, something to b, 1. Good. So the PP wave limit of strings, we will consider, lambda going infinity, because lambda is just proportional to r squared, so we want to take the radius of the sphere very long, very large, so we actually make sense of this classically, and then we consider j going to infinity with j over square root of lambda fixed. There's some subtleties with the limit here. You can take limits in different orders. You can, for example, hold j over n, a square root of n fixed, and then work it out such that you get the same quantities that you get here. But in that limit, you're basically keeping the coupling constant, the string coupling constant, finite for a second. And that includes, so you have to include non-planar diagrams. Because I want to consider the planar theory, this is the limit I'm taking. So I go to infinity, and then I do this scale. So in this case, it turns out that string theory is exactly solvable. Well, something I didn't say here is that this is related to integrability. So I want to say this. This spin change for planar spherules are believed to be integrable. So basically, you can solve this problem, and the fact that you can get this result, this implication is actually the case. So in this case, you can also solve the problem exactly. So you solve the problem exactly, and exact quantization gives this result. Okay. So remember that this was calculated for lambda going to infinity. So lambda going to infinity means, in this limit, that this is fixed, let's say fixed. I mean, that's a finite combination, lambda times p squared. Lambda goes to infinity, so you know, if I want to keep this and I want to see all the structure, p has to go to zero at the same time that lambda goes to infinity. And this makes sense because I'm analyzing what happens close to these states. So remember, the states I'm analyzing in gauge theory are states that were close to the that vacuum, and that vacuum was just the point going around the sphere. So I'm analyzing now states that are close to this state, some oscillations around this state, and because I don't want the strings to probe the entire sphere, just a small region around this space, I need the momentum to be small. So this is actually calculated with lambda p squared fixed. So p is very small, p goes to zero. This can be also written as this. Well, lambda prime is lambda over p squared. And I use that p is n over j. So that p is equals n over j comes from the quantization of p because this is a closed string, and in the same sense it comes from here that if you use the condition of the trace, p has to be n over j such that boundary conditions are obeyed. So that's just notation. Good. So this is a result. And the interesting thing now, and this is the result of PMN, is that if you take a very small p limit on this side of the story, you can look at this or you can look at this result, then you can combine lambda and p such that you make this combination. And you can calculate things in a regime where lambda prime is small and lambda is large just by adjusting j squared. So in that limit, we can compare both results because, well, lambda has to be large for this thing to make sense. Now we make lambda large here, which would take us away from the perturbative regime. But we take p so small that this thing remains small. And this I can still calculate reliably in perturbation theory. And, well, this is how they obtain this result. And then you can match the states on both sides of the story. This agrees after free loops, so it's a famous free loop discrepancy, and this might be related with the order of limits. So it's related to this problem I discussed here. And there's so many limits, and you have to take them in some order, and they might not commute. You probably won't commute. It's actually surprising that you have agreement up to this point, more than you have a disagreement in free loops. Good. So as I said, this result confirms that this function is this for weak Angstrom coupling. And good. There are other tools for analyzing this kind of problem, like semi-classical strings with large quantum numbers. Because once I was successful doing this, the characteristic of these states is that these have very large j, so they have large quantum numbers. So semi-classical states are similar in the sense that they also have large quantum numbers. And this kind of analysis can be repeated, and some surprising results are found where you can actually match the results on both sides of the story. So now, the questions that will take me to what I want to further discuss after this introduction are the following. First, Can we see sine p over 2 in string theory? So as you may have noticed, there's some interesting structure here, this function is given by a sine. But on the other side of the string theory, because I'm considering the states with very low p, I'm not probing the geometry enough to see this sign. So if the conjecture is right that these two theories are the same, this sign should appear in some way in the string theory. But in order to do that, I need to go to large p. I cannot take this limit of very small p to analyze the problem. This sign of p over 2 is also problematic in the sense that here it has a very definite reason to be there. This problem is defined on a lattice, it's defined on a spin chain. And these problems usually introduce this kind of expression relations where so they look like this, right? So it's a standard problem of condensed matter. We have dispersion relations that look like this. These are different from relativistic dispersion relations that grow and are not bounded. This one is bounded. So this is the reason why this appears in the gauge theory side. It's some small distance behavior in the spin chain related to the fact there's a minimal distance, that there's this is actually defined on a lattice. And the string theory side, this is not clear how it's going to happen. People thought at some point of saying that, well, once you quantize the string becomes kind of coarse, and there's some beats, and maybe this is what's happening. And people felt this sign might have something to do with quantization of string theory. I'll show that this is not the case, that this is actually related to the strings actually probing the whole sphere, and that this periodic structure is actually given by an angle in the sphere. So I'll discuss that. The second question is, well, once we've done this, is can we identify the string theory dual states to magnets. So these are the magnets, right? These are called magnets in spin chain theory language. And the question is, well, can I actually construct a string state that looks like this one for large p? We would call those giant magnets. So third question is related to integrability. So there's been a lot of discussion on this. Both theories seem to be integrable. They definitely are at the classical level and probably at the quantum level as well. So once I know this, I can use lots of techniques that come from integrable systems. In principle, I would like to calculate the spectrum and the S matrix exactly by a lot of techniques that are used in integrable systems. In particular, the S matrix was calculated for this problem using these techniques. And let me do this. So there's a BDS S matrix. So I want to emphasize that this S matrix is the Walshit S matrix. It's the S matrix that's defined in this chain, and it's defined in the Walshit in the string theory side. This is not the space-time S matrix of gravitons colliding. Something. These are just an S matrix inside the Walshit. So this was calculated, and there's a BDS S matrix which matches the result at weak lambda. There's the AFS result which matches this calculation at strong lambda. And what I want to say about this is this was calculated in a very indirect way. This is calculated by guessing some better equations for the classical strings, and then from that reading off the S matrix. So it's a very indirect way, and we'll match this result from very direct calculation. And finally, I want to add this. This is a paper that came out a few days ago. There's a new proposal for the S matrix that apparently matches, has the right properties at all. At all orders perturbatively around strong coupling. And this will be interesting because some states I will discuss are actually found with that S matrix. So this S matrix is very particular because also Weiser actually found it, except for an overall. So S matrix is known except for an overall phase. So there's a phase here, and this is known.
Is that fixed again for this?
Sorry?
Is that again fixed?
Yes, exactly. So it's just the same. So this is a very complicated object. This is 16 square by 16 square object. Pretty big. It's something that's in principle very difficult to calculate. The magic of integrability and symmetry, supersymmetry fixes this completely. And the only thing we don't know is an overall function. And these are guesses for this function that seem to work. And I'm going to calculate this specifically. So good. So what are we going to do? I work in the J going to infinity limit with B fixed. So I want to do this such that I actually can see things that have finite B. I will now emphasize that this is different from BMM, because in BMM, lambda is large, always, and also N equals B times J is fixed. So here I'm fixing P instead of N. And lambda here, in principle, is just some constant number. Lambda interpolates between gauge theory and string theory. The calculation I'm going to do is for large lambda. But this kind of limit you can take for finite lambda, and then move lambda to move from one side of the story to the other one. In the BMM limit, lambda was always large. So you did things predictably on lambda prime. Good, so I'm going to first find giant magnum solution. Good. So the first thing I'm going to do. Then I'm going to compute this first relation and show you that it matches that, almost. Then I'm going to say something about supersymmetry, and then I'm going to discuss the meaning of these charges to the string theory side of the story. And then I'll say something about the S-matrix and some bounds. So, okay. So let's discuss what do localized excitations on the worksheet look like in space-time. So let's just first think of flat space. So let's say we have, so this is my picture of the worksheet. So it's a worksheet with no excitations on it. So it means that all the points in the worksheet are basically on the same space-time point. That there's no excitations on top of this. So this is a picture in space-time where this is x plus, this is x minus, and this is my string. So this string is such that no field is excited on top of this. So all the fields take constant value on top of this. And this is just a point moving at the speed of light. This is similar to our Sudra state discussed over there. Now I can put some perturbation on top of this, and let's do this like this. I'm going to localize this. So these are excitations on top of the string, but they are localized. They have a very small size. And I'm given the configuration zero momentum such that I match the level, such that I satisfy the level matching conditions. And when I repeat this plot, what I get is the following. Which is something like this. So this is the string. Okay. So as these two perturbations cross each other, so here the space-time fields take one value, let's say one, and here they take another value, two. So this is one and two. So most of the string is concentrated around value one and value two, which are these two values, and there's two filaments that join these two values. So another picture of the string in space-time is something like this. Okay, so there's a lot of string here on one, which is all this stuff. There's a lot of string in two, which is here, which is this stuff. And there's two filaments joining these two points, which are these two excitations. Okay, so these two excitations map to these parts. And this is what they do in space-time. And as we can see, they move with something like that on average. So they're massive states that move at a speed less of light. So these two points change positions and they start moving backwards, right? As this moves forwards, it starts moving backwards. And what happens is that there's some momentum transfer from one side, from one point to the other. And when momentum runs out here, this point disappears, goes to the other side. Now, everything that I discussed is for a closed wall shape. What happens when I have an infinite wall shape? So here's the picture, it's like this. So this is infinite, and I have this perturbation here with momentum p. So the string looks like this. And what's interesting is now that this picture is like this. So as you can see, because the string is infinite, there's infinite string here, there's infinite string here. So no matter how much this thing moves to the right of the blackboard, it will never eat up all the string on the right-hand side. So there's always string on this side. I mean, momentum is flowing from this point to this point. But because we have infinite string, let's say, to start with, this string never runs out. So this is how the state looks like always. It never starts moving backwards. Good. Any questions on this? Good. So now that we learned this, let's go to ADS 5 process 5. And what I'm going to consider is strings on R process 2. The reason for considering this is because this S2 is enough to see the angle that I want to show. But it's also because this is related to the signboard model that I'm going to hopefully get to discuss at some point. And one comment that some objection can have on this is that the SE2 subsector in gauge theory matches to R cross of 3. So in principle, if you quantize this, I mean, there's something missing here in principle because you expect that the smallest closed subsector, which is SC2, should need a description on the string theory side that involves the whole S3. And this will actually turn out to be true in some way once you quantize the theory. But I'm going to consider classical solutions here. There's nothing wrong with that. So, procedure, I'm not going to look at this. I'm going to run out of time. But I'll consider an ambigotto string. So this is something like this. Yeah, I don't want to say that much about this. So the only thing I'm going to do is consider open strings given by the Nambu-Goto action. And I'm going to solve the equation of motion from the Nambu-Goto action. And what you get are solutions that look like this. So there's nothing new about this. I mean, the only thing that's new is that these solutions are open strings that people haven't considered before. So this thing is moving, rotating on the sphere, the same thing at that point. But now that this is stretched between two points on the sphere, so let's call this difference delta phi. And well, the solution, I can even write the solution for this. This maximal angle is if not. So this is the solution. So very common. Now, once I have a solution, I can calculate the energy of the solution classically, which is using the definition of energy in terms of the charges. So once I calculate this, this is the result I get. This is phi and time, so this is phi coordinate. This is theta. So I'm writing theta in terms of phi. This is just
and the arguments of psi. What is this?
This is just this constant, which is related to this constant also. It's just a constant. So it's just a constant, right? It's the height of the solution, which is the same thing as how much it is stretched.
So what's the boundary conditions at the end of the screen?
I'm just fixing them at the... Well, you don't have to do that. I mean, in principle, the only thing...
How can you not do it? I mean, you determine the, you know, the energy.
Sorry?
You're saying that this result is independent of the boundary?
No, I'm saying that in this case, the derivatives are also such that they vanish. And the only thing you're really concerned about is the energy. So you're requiring that your solution has finite energy. So that's what you're requiring your solution. That you, well, they will not have finite energy. They will have finite epsilon, right? So it should have infinite energy and infinite j, but they will have finite epsilon. So if you require that, you'll get this, which is the same as requiring, in this case, anything else. I mean, these are the solutions that make sense here. I mean, you can think of it as Dirichlet boundary conditions. But my point is that these strings do not want to shrink. It's not that I'm holding them like that. Right? They really don't want to shrink because these points are so heavy. There's so much string in there and they're moving the speed of light. So they have nowhere to go. They really can't move. Okay? That's nothing I'm saying. So this formula is what we want to obtain, which is this. Except for the problems. First problem, I need to set this. Delta phi has to be momentum. And I'll show in a minute that this is actually the case. So this you need in order to match this. And the other problem is, where's the one? There's a one under the square root over there, I don't see here. So the short explanation is that I'm calculating things at large lambda. So at large lambda, I can't see the one. See, at large lambda, I can just toss the one compared to this thing. So that's a short explanation. Long explanation, hopefully I'll be able to discuss some of that later on. So there's a good reason why this is the case. We need to talk about that. And in order to do that, I'm going to first do something else, which is change coordinates on this. There's several reasons why I want to change coordinates. One is that I want to be able to match this model to the sine order model, so I need different coordinates. Another reason is that I want to match this with gauge theory results. And gauge theory results are such that if you look at it, the density of J is constant, at least away from the perturbation. Perturbation is very small in gauge theory, so it doesn't really matter. But away from the perturbation, the density of J is constant. So I would like to go to coordinates such that the density of J is also constant. Another reason why you want to do this is that if you solve this thing in conformal gauge using the polytop action, you get these coordinates also quite naturally. So the solution in that case is following. So I want to say, well, so I'm assuming delta phi is equal to p in this equation. Good. Where this is the following. So my new coordinates are x and t, where x is a coordinate such that the density of angular momentum is constant. So I'll write it dg j over dx. It's just square root lambda over pi. So here, density of j is just 1, so there's some overall scaling. That's all. It's still constant. And also, velocity in gauge theory of your perturbation is just, let's say like this. Well, dl is just the gauge theory coordinate, gauge theory distance. So this is just the dp, and this is just square root of lambda 2 pi. Good. So that's the velocity of the perturbation in the gauge theory side of the story. By doing the same thing on the string side, and you can read off from this form of the from the dependence of the field from the coordinates that this is just cos. So put that phi if you want here. But this is a velocity, right? Everything that has this kind of configuration is moving with this velocity, right? So the point that the velocity is this, so delta phi has momentum. Basically, it's a way of defining momentum. It's just defining momentum such that this is true, that the velocity is the derivative of epsilon with respect to p. So if you take epsilon and p here, and calculate this, the way to define p such that this is true, that velocity equals this formula, is by matching delta phi with p. So it's just a standard mechanics. It's just defining p for this system. So good. So p is delta phi, and this explains why you get this periodic behavior. What's really happening is that the string here is probing the whole sphere. And at some point, you stretch the string between two points which are opposite to each other. And that's the maximum stretching you can have. So that's the reason why your spectrum is bounded here. It's a very different reason why it's bounded against here. This is like some kind of a long distance effect, and there is a short distance effect. So there's some interesting physics here, and it's nothing related to quantization or anything like that. This you can actually see in the semi-classical space. So another way of analyzing this, and I want to discuss now the symmetries and the charges in the string theory side, is the following. We can change coordinates again, now space-time coordinates, and go to LLM coordinates. These are coordinates that are defined in the LLM paper including Lina Magdalena. So in those coordinates, strings just look like this. So the only thing I'm doing is I'm projecting the sphere on a plane that cuts the sphere in half. So this has the strings look from above, the sphere, right? So the whole sphere is given by the inside of the disk, and the strings stretch from one side of the disk to the other side of the disk. So this angle is p. And in this coordinate, the metric inside this disk is flat. It's actually flat. You can actually check that you get a flat metric inside the disk. So there's something interesting happening here, which is the following. This is very similar to a string stretching between two D-brains. So what happens is that the 10-dimensional SUSY algebra is such that gauge transformation, that they include gauge transformation of the V field.
So
yes?
Can you just say interesting, so whether we now, so we finish the strings off, and the string will come back with the gauge theory, and now you're trying to discuss.
I want to change to these coordinates because these are the coordinates that will make it very easy to discuss. To discuss this problem, to discuss the symmetries of the theory. And what I'm going to say is I'm going to rewrite this result, and I'm going to rewrite this enlarged central charge from string theory. I'm going to repeat this derivation in string theory.
So this S2 is what this.
I'm just projecting the S2 on a plane. So this how the solutions look. You look from the north pole.
And the coordinates of the disk are the ones we define above.
These are new coordinates, right? That define x1 and x2. Yeah. So this is x1, x2. And this parameterizes the plane that cuts the sphere in half. Mm-hmm.
So, yes? I'm probably repeating the question, but should I think of those open that configuration as some D3-brain wrapping the other S3 inside the 5-sphere? Is that how you think of this? And fluctuations of this brain? Or?
Well, we've thought of that. Not in principle, no. These are just the problem with the solutions. The solutions are not actually in the spectrum of the theory, right? Mm-hmm. You have to keep that in mind. I'm making a trip. I'm just considering open strings because what I show now, because this is enlarges the algebra. Because of this enlargement of the algebra, these states are actually VPS. And because they are VPS, I can say something about them. So these states, I mean, these are not physical states. I'm going to discuss what physical states look like in a minute. But you can, I mean, I'm just thinking of these states as a string stretch in a way. They're open strings, but they're not standard open strings in the sense that they have infinite Rorschach length. So this string has to have infinite Rorschach length. What makes the string stay here, you say, okay, maybe I put D-brains and that's why they stay there. What I can answer is that they stay there not because of D-brains, they stay there just because there's an infinite amount of string lying in those points. So these points, they don't like to move. And this is because I'm considering states with infinite Rorschach. Okay. So what I say here is that the ten-dimensional Sugra supersymmetry is such that it involves gauge transformations of the B field. And because this is the case, strings are charged under the B field and they carry winding charges. Winding charges you get when you wrap a string around a cycle, but you also get with string stretch between D-brains. And this is the reason why strings stretch between D-brains are VPS. Because the stretch, so they have some energy. So you might think, okay, that's not the minimal energy that I can have. But the point is that they have some topological charge because they're stretched. So they have the minimal energy that they can have such that you have those charges. Here the same thing happens, and you get that there's two charges given by K1 and K2. And for this solution, they are the following. So you were asking what the formula for this thing was in the gauge. This is the same formula. This is the central charges in the gauge series. So this is just the length of the string. And what happens is that the algebra is such that it looks like a 2 plus 1 Poincaré algebra. So these are like the momenta of this algebra, but they're really the winding charges of the string. It's how much the string stretch. So the formula for the energy is the following. Just because of the algebra, so like this. Okay, so you get this just because this looks like a 2 plus 1 Poincaré algebra, and once you write this in terms of this, you get what you want. Now. There's some subtleties here. The subtlety is that this looks like a Lorentz symmetry calculation. This looks like this is so because of boost symmetries. Boosts are not a symmetry of this algebra. Boosts are an automorphism of the algebra. So you have to be careful about that. Boosts are not a symmetry. Rotations are. You can rotate the string around the circle, and that's fine. But boosts are not symmetry. So this is. I think the best way of thinking of this formula is as a VPS formula, not as a relativistic formula, because the theory is not relativistic. So this is a VPS state, and I actually found the extended the central charges that extend the algebra. So this is completely parallel to what Beisler has done for the gauge series out of the story. So actually we can match that result, and we get the exact same thing. This has to be, just because of symmetry, this has to be the energy problem.
So could you say something about the supergravity solution? Is there a non-supergravity solution to this thing? No, so how do you construct it? I mean, there's you're imposing how many supersymmetries, what's the ansatz that you have to be
I'm just finding a classical solution of string theory, which in some approximations are solutions to the supergravity.
So what's the ansatz? What's the ansatz you make?
I'm just finding a solution to the Namdogoth equation. I'm not thinking of this in supergravity. I mean, just finding.
So there is no you don't have a supergravity solution.
Yes, exactly. I'm not thinking of it that way. I'm just thinking of finding a solution of strings in R process two.
Right, but presumably there is, I mean, there has, if you're saying that these states have some surf charges that are fairly used to the symmetry algebra, then there has to be a solution.
Yes, so this strings at stretch are some kind of perturbation of this ADS 5 plus 5 drop, right? So the point that this is not a small perturbation, it's not like PMN states that you can think of just ripples around the circle, right? So that's a supergravity solution for VMN states, right? For VMN states, you have a point going around the sphere, and you solve the string theory problem, and that gives us some perturbations around that point, right? So that's a string picture. You want to now go to supergravity picture, and what you do is to say, okay, my solution, thinking of this as bubbling ADS, our solution is supergravity solution is just a circular droplet, and then these VMN states are just ripples going around the droplet. The point is because these states are heavier, they are more complicated perturbations of this droplet, right? But classically they don't look very different from VMN states. They just stretch longer.
Yeah. But so I mean, I don't know how hard it is, but there should be. I mean, you know what the symmetries are,
right?
And so on, and you should be able to make an ansatz and solve the. And you know that they, you know that they BPS, so you should be able to.
The only remark I want to make is that we have to remember that these are not really solutions, such as solutions.
Yeah, they're not filters.
Exactly. So they're not going to satisfy level matching conditions. They don't satisfy gauge invariance. So in order to build something that actually has a chance of being a supergravity solution, you need to close the string such that you get zero momentum. That's just my only that's the only caveat. But these are not actually solutions, right? These are solutions that are charged under some generators that have to annihilate physical states, right? So our physical solution, your supergravity solution, is such that they have zero charge under this generator. These are charged. Okay, so how much time do I have?
That's the most.
Infinite?
No. 7.
Huh?
Yeah.
How much time do you need?
I don't know, like, shall we need 15 minutes?
Just go ahead.
Okay, good. So, can you comment, based on what you just said, how should I think about these magnums on the gauge series side? So you're saying they're on the string series side, mm-hmm. but they're not physical states. Mm-hmm. But those magnums are well defined.
No, they're not. That's the problem. You need two of them.
Oh, okay. So you're saying, I see. So because you restrict it to a single. Okay, good sense.
Mm-hmm. Good. So this actually mimics that calculation in string theory. And once we have this picture, then I can show you a physical state. I mean, there are more complicated physical states. But in particular, I can show you a physical state. Physical state is something like this. I'm really bad at this, so bear with me for a second. Okay, good. So now I plot the string, right? So this string goes like this, and if you calculate the charge under these generators, you'll see it's zero. So this string is a string that doesn't have any winding charges. So it's an actual physical state, and it won't be BPS, right? This string has some energy, and it's not the minimal energy for a state that has no charge, right? This is a non-BPS physical state. So this is how you build physical states from the magnets. So this is the beauty of it. In a sense, physical states, I mean, these are not physical states, but these are the building blocks of physical states in a way. The same way these are not physical gauge invariant states, but you make gauge invariant states of these things by adding more of these perturbations and required momentum adds up to zero.
How do you estimate the energy?
That's a good question. I don't know, they're not BPS.
Well, but you can maybe classically compute.
Yeah, that is true. So good. So so what you can do is because this states because the theory is integrable, I can think of this. If this man is at some point very far away, I mean, I just sum the energy of it. And this is what I'm going to do in a second. So I'm actually going to answer your question for a simpler state than this. But this is where integrability plays a big role. Energy is just add up. And I'll show this in a minute.
You mentioned Sandgolden before.
I'll talk about Sandgolden now. So, now I want to calculate the S matrix. So, calculate the S matrix, calculating something for a scattering state. By the way, scattering state is something like this. with something that has two strings at some point, then that's something that looks like this again. So this state is static in a sense, right? It just goes around the sphere, but this is going to change, right? Its shape. It's not going to stay like that. This state is also going to change its shape, but it's going to look like this asymptotically. And this is, for example, the scattering state. So in order to calculate the scattering state, I'm going to use something that people knew at some point. I'm going to write this fast, which is that strings on R cross S2 is classically the same as the sine wave of model. Good. So S matrix. So classically, sine golden is the same as strings on R cross S2. Good. Actually, the map, I can even write a map, is this. Where this is a sine golden field, and this is just a vector on S2. Okay? And I'm using time as a parameter. So by using this map, it turns out, and this actually why we also changed to the score, because we also found the solutions in the sine golden model. Because this is such that sine golden solitons are just our diamagnets. So it's very simple. What's not simple is, for example, the following. The energies are like this. So if you calculate the energy of this configuration of the soliton in the sine golden model, and you compare it with our energy, they're related like this. They're inverse to each other. This is not very good. This happens because sine golden model and strings on R cross S2 have different Poisson structures. And this means that these theories are classically the same, but they're quantum mechanically different. They're very different. They have different S matrices, they have different behaviors. And this is because their actions are different. So there's all different ways of saying the same thing. So I said this, or there's different Poisson structure. And in particular, this makes it difficult to calculate the energies. If you know one kind of energy, it's not easy to calculate the other one. For the magnets, it's simple because you can calculate both ways, find the solution, that's it. But now I'm going to do something different, which is, okay, so before going on, I'd like to say that there's a Lorentz symmetry in the sine golden model, and that generates a one parameter family of solutions. Those solutions are the ones that have different p over here. So all these different solutions with different p's are just given by different solitons with different velocity. Now this, again, is it's not a symmetry of the theory. This is just a symmetry of that I used to generate this new solution in time golden theory, but it's not a symmetry of our theory. And so the scattering solution, it's easy to build now that I know this. And this is because scattering solution in sine golden is just a scattering solution in strings on R cross S2. This happens because X and T, our coordinates, are the same on both sides. So these two solutions represent scattering on both sides of the story. Now the problem is now, if I want to calculate, for example, I have to calculate N, I have to calculate this matrix, but the point is that the way I will calculate this matrix is by calculating the time delay of two particles that go through each other. So I will do that in the sine golden model because I know how to do that, and the time delays are the same because X and T are just the same. The X matrices will not be the same though, and the reason is that the energies are not the same, and I'll show you how to calculate the S matrices, and you'll see that they have to be different. But what's difficult is that if you have this scattering solution for sine golden, It's not very easy to calculate the scattering solution for string theory. In particular, it's not easy to calculate the energy, let's say. The reason is that this map is not very easy to invert. If you know the string solution, it's very easy to find the sine-Gordon solution. But if you know the sine-Gordon solution, it's not very easy to find the string solution. So in order to calculate this, you have to find a way to calculate the energy of this solution. And this is where integrability comes in, because theory is integrable. The energy has to be the sum of the energies of these two states. This is very easy to see, because at the beginning of scattering, these particles are very far away. They don't see each other, and it's just sum of their energies. It will be a little bit more complicated for bound states. But this you can actually prove. We actually proved this, and we could not invert the solution when we first calculated this. But we solved it as some space-time slice and calculated the energy there, and it's actually true that it's just the sum of the energy.
So, yes. I'm quite confused, because you're saying it's classically the same, but then you put many modifications.
What do you
say that they have...
I'm saying that the equation of motion is, that's what I'm saying. And then the energy on one side is different from the energy on the other side. That's fine, that's not a problem. Still solutions, for one solution on one side, I have a solution on the other side. That's still true. The only thing I'm saying with this is that calculating the energy, the sine-Gordon model, doesn't help me at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, in this case, they're related like this, but for the solutions, they're not related like this. I actually show how they're related, because these are additive, so it means that you just keep adding stuff like that. But it's not just inverting the energy of the... This is only true for solutions.
So what is the range of application of this?
Well, it's not clear. I mean, some people think that string theory can be quantized with different Pascal structure, and that makes sense. And so maybe sine-Gordon helps. But the truth is that, because some people say that we don't really know what's the right Pascal structure in which we want to quantize this thing. The truth is that, in principle, in a very naive way, there are different quantum theories. There are different actions. They just happen to have the same equations of motion. So I was talking about inverting the solution. This is not easy in general. It can be done by vacuum transformations, and we did that afterwards. And there was a paper by Spradlin and Bolovich where they actually calculated these scattering solutions explicitly by using the Dressing method. So these solutions can be calculated on the string side. The point is that for calculating these methods, you don't need them. The only thing you need is the time delay. And the time delay in the sine-Gordon theory is already calculated. That's known. And then the only thing that's left here is that in WKV approximation, maybe this is, can you see this? So by knowing the time delay, I know the S matrix. So the derivative, in the WKV approximation, the derivative of the phase of the S matrix with respect to energy is just the time delay. So by knowing this and knowing the energy, which, again, you can assume it's just the sum of them, and then we actually calculate it's actually true, but integrability tells you that it has to be the sum. You can integrate this formula and obtain the phase. And here you can actually see that the S matrices are actually different for sine-Gordon for string theory, because the energies are different, so the integration is different. Well, I'm not going to write a formula, but we calculated this phase. Let me go on here. I'm almost done. And the result is the following. So we calculate this, and we obtain the same result as the AFS result, which is the one I talked about in the beginning of the talk, where I said that was the conjecture result for strong coupling that came from a very different calculation. This is a very concrete, very direct calculation. And it's not the exact same result because of this term. And what I want to say here is that this term is not physical. This term is only a redefinition of distances. So what I said is that at the very beginning, I went to go to coordinates such that the density of J was constant. And we did that, but that we did only away from the perturbation. So if you have perturbation, here j equals constant. So here's constant, and here's constant. Here's not. This didn't matter to us when we were calculating just one of this. But if you have two of this, then as this one goes through this one, if you change this definition, then it changes the time delay, because it changes basically what's the width of this solution. So it changes you have to go through a larger path to go through a wider perturbation than a narrower perturbation. So this is important in this case. It's not important for what we did before, but in this case, it's important to define your coordinate such that j is constant everywhere, not just away from the perturbation. Well, you can do that. You can change coordinates as you do that. In our coordinates, what turns out to be constant throughout the axis is the energy, not j. So, well, you can write this like that. I'm just rewriting everything, not doing anything. So now you see that the length defined in the gauge theory, this is the length in gauge theory where j is constant, is related to our length by, well, this is just a factor, the same factor that we encountered before, and minus the energy. So if you look, for example, at the Vetter equations, which are like this, just one S for two particles, then you see that if you change the length by this, which is what we're doing, you get an extra factor here, right? Something like this. And this is what we're doing. This is what we got in the phase. We got this extra term here, just because distances are different. So once you match that, the results actually agree. So AFS, we actually got AFS result by actually doing the scattering of functions, which is something they didn't do at the form. They just get the result from some beta equations.
So AFS is only for the SDP factor, or is more general?
No, you can generalize that, and you can change that a little bit. Because the only thing that's really difficult is the phase. You know the matrix. So going from one sector to another, it's just looking at Bayes' matrix and see what you have to add. Mm-hmm. So the important thing is the phase. And you can, the solution is good for any sector. It's different, right, for different sectors, as you know. So the only thing I want to say now, because I'm running out of time, minus 15 minutes or so. So doing the same calculation, you can find bound states. These bound states are matched to the bound states in some order of theory. So this is how we find them. Here, inverting is difficult also. And, well, we check numerically that the energy is still add. It's still difficult. But again, the solutions were found by some other methods. And you can quantize this bound states because they're periodic, so you can do WKV quantization of the states, you can quantize it. And the spectrum of these states, right here, for bound states, the spectrum is the following.
So now you're using some results of bound states of time.
Exactly. I know there's some bound states in Sine-Gordon, so those have to be bound states on the other side. And I repeat the whole calculation, I calculate the energy, and then I quantize using WKV quantization. And in this case, you get epsilon.
What is the justification for the WKV quantization?
In the string theory side, the states are periodic. So I know how to quantize that. It's just some Borel, Sommerfeld, Borel quantization. That's all I'm doing. So semi-classically, this is reliable. It's not reliable beyond that. But I mean, for large n, it's reliable. It's not reliable for small n. Okay? So it's, of course, for large lambda as well, right? You need large radius.
How does it cope with what you said before, that they don't have the same problem?
No. I'm not using the quantization of this state. I'm just stealing the classical solution from Sine-Gordon I'm mapping to a classical solution that I know it exists.
Then you quantize it semi-classical.
Right.
Take the semi-classical.
Okay, so if you don't like it, just forget about the time-going model. Just if you're smart enough, find this bouncy solution, this thing here. You find it, you find this periodic, you quantize it. Forget about the time-going model. This is how we did it. This is how we knew the state, these solutions were there. If you don't know this, it's very non-trivial to find the solution. They're actually really complicated. They've been found explicitly, but they're complicated. So this is reliable for large n, large lambda. And there's two things to notice here. One thing is that these states are heavier than two Magnum states. So these are very weird bound states because they're not lighter than two single particle states. They're actually heavier. And this is related to this. I mean, in Sangoram, all this happens, but because energies have some finite relation, here these states, which we call bounces, are actually heavier than two single particle states. So the first thing you can say is, okay, these states are going to decay into single particle states. But this is where integrability comes in, because this theory is integrable, and these states are made of two single particle states with complex momenta. That's how you build bound states in the Sangoram theory, for example. They cannot decay, because decaying would mean that they could scatter two particles with complex momentum, get two particles with real momentum. But integrability tells you that in a scattering process, you can only interchange momenta, but you cannot change the value of momentum. So integrability is the only thing that's keeping these states from decaying. So these states, in principle, are there. They should not decay. And of course, they're there for large n. For small n, this is not reliable. And even worse, there's an infinite number of them. You can just put n to be whatever you want. So there's an infinite number of these functions. This looks very, very weird. I mean, it's not clear what the states are at weak coupling. So if they are weak coupling, you have to find them, see what they are. Because they're non-BPS, it's a mess, it's not clear. You could actually tell what they are. And if they're not there, it means that something strange happens at finite lambda. And when I say something strange, I mean stranger than what happens in the Sangoram theory. In Sangoram theory, you have a number of bound states. And as you move the coupling, you expel bound states outside of the physical region, and they're not there anymore at some point. But you expel them one by one. In this case, because there's an infinite number of them, it seems that at some point you have to expel all together, some accumulation point. If they're not there, we couple. I mean, I'm not saying they're not there, I'm just saying if that's the case. So this is a puzzle, and when we wrote this paper, we said that, well, these states are important because knowing something about the states will tell you something about the analytic structure of the S matrix at strong coupling. And then I said something about this new S matrix found by Weiser, Hernandez, and Lopez. And this new S matrix that claims to be exact to all perturbation theory around strong coupling actually finds these states. These states are actually coded in this S matrix. So this is a nice feature of this S matrix, that these bounces that were actually weird and, well, before this analysis were not found are actually there in this exact S matrix.
Sorry,
you said
the Magnum was not physical?
Yes.
Are these physical when you...
Yeah, you can make them physical by fixing the Magnum. Yes.
So how, since they are far from BPS, how would you know at weak coupling that there is a corresponding operator?
I know. That's the point. If there's none, then it means that they go away at some value of the coupling.
No, I would say that they're probably there, but you would never, I mean, how would you tell that they are corresponding to the coupling? There is no quantum number anymore, right? No? When you make it physical, this be.
Well, integrability, I mean, if you think you could solve this theory, if you think you could solve string theory for all values of the coupling, yes, then you could think of moving the coupling and see how the states move, right, continuously.
Yes.
And it seems at some point they disappear, or they become something that I don't know.
Well, I think that the second option is...
Good, then that's what might happen. That's actually, the perspective of Weiser and Anderson Lopez. They say that they should be there. It might be something very weird, but they should be there. It's not clear. I don't know what they are. In truth, they're complicated from the gauge theory point of view. So I'm done. I just want to finish saying that there's been some progress on these issues. finite size effects have been calculated. Other solutions in similar limits were also studied. Beta deformed backgrounds were studied, and these kind of solutions were found as well. Multi-spin solutions were also constructed. And the only thing I want to add now is that I didn't say anything about that one under the square root. And well, there's two things you can say about it. One thing is that a classical solution with that one has actually been found by Dori and collaborators. And that's a giant magnet that's also spinning on an extra circle. So these solutions actually live in R cross F3, like we wanted them to live, because if you want to match the SE2 sector, you want them to live in R cross F3. And if you take this giant magnet solution exactly as it is, and you add a spin in this extra direction, you get an angular momentum, and that angular momentum adds just a number in front of it. So instead of getting a 1, you get a J squared, where you can tune that. If it's quantized semi-classically, then J is quantized. And there's a solution where J is 1. What that solution does not say is why it can't be 0. Because we know from the gauge theory side from Susi arguments, the solution has a 1. There's no solution with 0 like this one. So you have to understand why 0 is not allowed. So the way to do that is, in principle, and that's the other perspective on that one, is that these solutions that we found, these giant magnet solutions, you can in principle quantize the solutions, I mean classically, by calculating perturbations on top of it. And if you do that, well, you'll find this solution that has angular momentum on top of it. And presumably by doing some collective coordinate quantization and saying something about the serial rules, you'll find which values of J are allowed. And you should find that 0 is not allowed. Doing this is complicated because you have to add all the fermions to do it properly. You cannot just break the theory and take this part and quantize this. I mean, in order to actually get this result, you need to include the fermions. And that makes the story much more complicated. So that's pretty much all I have to say. This is good. We found fundamental blocks of the theory on both sides of the story now, because we knew what the magnets were on one side. Now we know what the fundamental blocks are on the other side. Well, and hopefully this will allow for a better understanding of the S matrix, and maybe even find it exactly on the lines of what Weissert and Anderson Lopez did. Thank you. I'm sorry I took so much of your time.
Only 1 hour and a half.
Any further questions? So in this Weissert formula, one can also be basically any integer?
No, that's already known. That you don't need that to get there. You can cut, I mean, it's known, for example, that in the SU2 sector, there are bound states of these magnets. If you make a bound state of 2 magnets, they have J equals 2, right? And then you can make more and more bound states. And that was actually found by Dori as well. So all integers seem to be allowed, not zero.
So it's complete.